the more aggressive terror organizations, tended to be rather intelligent. If one of those groups had the wherewithal to track her down like this, they'd never be dumb enough to send a Muslim man or even a Muslim woman to lure her out of her apartment. The minute she saw either on her doorstep, her antennae would be up. The tipsy blonde with the fender bender story was the perfect ploy. Was this about one of the countless harsh interrogations she had conducted? Because if so, there wasn't a single one that she would go back and change. She believed in the methods the CIA used, including the ones that members of Congress would never know about. They had no idea the type of determined enemy the United States faced. And while she believed in harsh interrogation methods, most of them were tactics that she would never want to be submitted to. What worried her even more was that boastful lies and one-upmanship were the Muslim terrorists' stock in trade. This went double for stories of capture and interrogation at the hands of the Americans. No matter what had happened in an interrogation, there'd always be one of them quick to jump up and claim they had a worse one. It led to a very perverse view of what Americans actually did in their interrogations. It was why the thought of being kidnapped by Al-Qaeda or a similar group was something that kept some CIA personnel up at night. They knew that if they were ever grabbed, the interrogation wouldn't be harsh, it would be brutal, and it would definitely be torture. There was no way Ryan was ever going to submit to that, even if avoiding it meant throwing herself out of a moving vehicle. While she tried to keep track of the movement of the van, she also tried to keep calm as she sought a way to get free. But she was on her stomach, her naked body half exposed beneath her open robe, with her hands and feet bound up hogtie style. She remembered watching a video once of someone actually getting out of being duct taped. It involved twisting the hands down and out with a quick pop. It also required that your hands be bound in front, something professionals never did. Rolling onto her right side, she inched in that direction, praying that she'd find a screw or an exposed piece of metal, anything that could be used to cut through the tape and get herself free. There was nothing, so she rolled onto her opposite side and slowly felt her way along the filthy floor in that direction. It was just as fruitless. But then, she felt something. It was a small, narrow strip of metal banding, the kind used to secure loads to a wooden pallet. It was about half an inch wide and only an inch long. It wasn't exactly sharp, but it had been cut on an angle and therefore had a point. Gripping it as best she could, Ryan ignored the pounding in her chest and went to work on her restraints. About 15 minutes later, she felt the van make another turn. Based on the speed and lack of stoplights, she figured they had been on Route 123, headed out of Fairfax. Now, they were headed in a new direction.
Toward what? A safe house? The forest?
She worked harder on the duct tape. It had been wrapped around so many times, Ryan couldn't tell if she was making any progress at all. A few minutes later, the vehicle began to slow, as if the driver was looking for something. An address or a road sign, maybe.
No, she said half to herself, half in prayer. Don't stop yet. I need more time. Please. I need more time.
Frantically, she rubbed and stabbed at the tape with a little piece of banding. She could feel the time on her clock running out. Whatever the driver was looking for, he must have found it, because he made another turn, this time onto a rough, uneven surface. Ryan thought it might be a dirt road of some sort, but after several hundred yards, she felt the van make a sharp cut and come to a stop.
Was it a turnout, or were they in a driveway of some sort?
For several minutes, nothing happened. The van just idled. As best she could tell, no one had gotten out. They were just sitting there. Why? What was going on? Were they waiting for something or someone? Through the hood, she could hear voices coming from the cab, Chrissy and the boyfriend. It sounded like they were arguing. There was a crescendo as Chrissy, who must have been driving, punctuated her words by throwing the van into reverse and stepping on the accelerator. The tires spun wildly, before finally biting into the dirt and finding purchase. And that's when it happened. Just as the van was beginning to back up, something slammed into it from behind. Hard. Chapter 24. As soon as he saw the van's reverse lights come on, Bob McGee knew he was going to get blown. He'd never be able to reverse his own vehicle fast enough, much less turn around and find a place to hide. There was only one way he could hope to turn this to his advantage, and he took it. Slamming the gas pedal to the floor, he aimed right for it. The force of the impact sent the van skidding sideways. Before its occupants knew what had happened, McGee was out of his 4Runner, 1911 pistol in hand, rushing the cab. In the less than 3 seconds it took him to get there, both the male passenger and female driver had scrambled for their weapons and were about to bring them up high enough to fire at him. Big mistake. McGee killed them both, with two 45 caliber rounds to the chest and one to the head, fired in rapid succession. The shots from his 1911 echoed through the wooded area like thunder. After inserting a fresh magazine, he took better cover and yelled, "Lydia, can you hear me? Lydia!" There was no response. Cautiously, he crept forward, and grasping the handle, slid the door back. He found her, still hogtied and up against the side of the van. Taking off her hood, he peeled back the tape from across her mouth as gently as he could. "Are you okay?" he asked, as he pulled out his knife and cut her hands and feet free. Ryan covered herself with her robe as McGee helped roll her into a sitting position.
"I'm okay," she said, pulling at the tape around her wrists. "What happened? Are they dead?"
"Yeah, they're dead. Both of them."
"How'd you find me?"
"They sent a team to my house, too. It's a good thing I get up every 2 hours to piss, or they might have gotten me also. I tried to call your cell."
Ryan shook her head. "I needed some sleep. It was turned off."
"Well, when you didn't answer, I rushed to your place. Got there just as they were loading you into the van."
"Why didn't you do something?"
McGee put up his hands. "I needed to make sure there wasn't a tail gunner or some sort of support team in a follow car."
"Why didn't you pit them to get them to spin out or run them off the road?
And have the van flip over? Something told me they probably didn't take the time to put a seatbelt on you. Listen, I picked my moment. They're dead, and you and I are both alive." He was right.
"Who the hell are they?"
McGee held up his index finger, indicating he'd be right back. Stepping out of the cargo area, he moved back to the cab, and after making sure both of the occupants were dead, he conducted a quick search. He returned to the cargo area with a black duffel bag, which he set on the floor and opened up. 2 H&K MP5s, 2 Glock 19s, couple of tasers, duct tape, power bars, some water bottles, a cell phone, which is probably a burner and won't lead anywhere, and enough ammo to take on a small Latin American army.
"But no ID?" asked Ryan.
"No."
"So they're pros."
McGee nodded. Occam's razor. The simplest explanation was usually correct. They had come after both of them, but before today, there wasn't anything that she and McGee shared that somebody could want to kill them over. All of that had changed since she had confronted Durkin. This wasn't a coincidence. This had to be tied to him. She could feel it.
"Did you see any books?" she asked.
"Books?"
"A paperback of some sort."
"Now that you mention it," said McGee as he returned to the front of the van. Ryan could hear him open the cab.
"Durkin liked to use them for codes," she said, loud enough for him to hear. "French lit, translated into English. Rousseau or some author like that."
McGee returned and tossed an aged paperback to her. "Balzac."
"Damn it. It is Durkin then."
"Or," McGee said, his voice trailing off.
"Or what?"
"Or this is bigger than either of us thought, and Johnson is involved too." Ryan looked at him.
"The DNI? You've got to be joking. I thought he was someone you trusted."
"At this point, you're the only one I trust, and until we get to the bottom of this, that's the way it's going to stay." She winced as she pulled the last piece of duct tape from her arm.
"Why'd they drive me all the way out here?"
"It's as good a place as any to dump a body, or maybe even two bodies. When I rolled up, they were trying to signal someone with their headlights, but I never saw anyone signal back. They waited a while and either got spooked or decided to move to Plan B."
"Who do you think they were signaling?"
"I don't know. Maybe this was a rendezvous with the team who came gunning for me."
Did the men at your house have guns? Ryan asked. Or tasers?
Both. Why?
Because if they'd wanted to kill us, they would have. Why bother giving tasers to a wet work team?
Lots of reasons.
No, she disagreed. This has to be about the Jordanians. It's the only reason we'd both be targeted. And I told Durkin everything. There's nothing he could gain from interrogating me. He knows all of it already.
What if he wanted to know who else you might have told about the Jordanians?
Then he could have asked me. Listen, the only reason Durkin could possibly have to snatch me alive is that he wanted to kill me someplace else other than my apartment. And apparently, he didn't want me to die alone, which means he had something cooked up to explain why you and I died out here together in the middle of nowhere.
Did you tell Durkin you were going to talk to me? Asked McGee.
No.
Then that would mean he had a tail on you. So he not only knows that you talked to me, but that we talked to Johnson. How could he hope to get away with killing us?
I hate to say it, but either you're right and Johnson's involved, or Durkin came up with something so airtight he was convinced our deaths could be explained away without even the DNI asking any questions. Either way, I don't think you and I were supposed to walk out of here tonight.
I think you're right. So now what?
Now? We get the hell out of here, replied Ryan, as she grabbed one of the MP5s from the bag and moved toward the door. McGee extended her his hand to help her exit, and then gathered up the duffel.
What should we do about the van and the bodies? He asked.
Ryan looked inside the cab. In addition to the two corpses slumped over in their seats, the cab was splattered with blood and pieces of brain.
If we had enough time to clean it up and make it look like we took their people hostage, I'd say let's opt for that. But all we've got time to do now is burn it. Let's burn the entire thing.
McGee nodded, and after throwing the duffel in his forerunner, he backed it a safe distance away. While he got to work on the van and prepared to set it on fire, Ryan walked over to the spot from where he had been shooting. With a flashlight from his glove box, she began looking along the dirt road for the shell casings from his 1911. It took several minutes, but she was able to locate all six.
Got 'em, she said, as she pocketed the last one. You ready?
Good to go, he said, flashing her the thumbs up.
They drove out of the woods and toward the highway, just as the van exploded in a billowing fireball. When they arrived at the junction where the dirt road ended and the pavement began, he stopped and asked,
Okay, which way, south or north?
They both knew that neither of them could go home. They had to go to ground, someplace safe, someplace where they could assess and plan their next move. Ryan removed the atlas wedged next to her seat and studied it for a moment. Finally, she said,
South.
McGee accelerated and turned onto the pavement.
Where are we headed?
How long will it take us to get to Fort Belvoir from here?
About 20 minutes, why? What's at Belvoir?
Ryan looked over at him and replied,
For the moment? Sanctuary.
What do you mean, sanctuary?
I mean, Belvoir has one of the last rocks in the world Durkin would ever think of looking under.
Knowing Durkin, McGee countered, he's going to be looking under every rock.
Not this one, Ryan said. Trust me.
Chapter 25. Boston, Massachusetts. The four-story red brick office building was a block east of Boston Common, at the corner of Washington and Essex Streets. On its ground floor was an entrance to the subway station and a smattering of retail space, including a Dunkin' Donuts. On the fourth floor was the killer's destination, a Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles office. Keys, as well as the building's layout and the RMV's alarm code, had already been provided for him. He kept a silenced semi-automatic beneath his coveralls, but it had not proved necessary. It was the middle of the night, and the building was vacant. No one would have any idea he was there. All he needed to focus on was his assignment. Using the service elevator, he brought all of his equipment, including the man inside the commercial-grade rolling trash can, whom he had drugged with the same paralytic he had used on the woman in Georgia, to the fourth floor. Once he had ascertained where he needed to set up, he positioned all of his gear and began to unpack.
He wasn't a fan of the coarse hemp rope. It was thick and difficult to deal with. He would have preferred to use a modern climbing rope, but the instructions had been explicit. Cautious not to be seen from the street, he used his small flashlight sparingly and never near the windows. Even at this hour, there were still people on the street stopping and looking up at the building's facade. Most would be armed with cell phone cameras, and some might even be disposed to take a picture or two. He couldn't afford to be caught in anyone's casual photos. Within a few hours, everyone was going to be talking about this building, and anyone who had passed by and snapped a picture was going to be reviewing their footage to see if they unknowingly caught anything that might have warned of what was to come. With everything staged, he attached the hoses together and ran the end with the rubber faucet adapter to the restroom. Even though the trash can had wheels, it would be difficult to move. He preferred to position it and then fill it in place. Things would be much easier that way. As the water sloshed into the trash can, he looked at his watch and measured the rate of flow. He had planned for every eventuality: a late office worker, a random security patrol, being accosted by another cleaning company, anything that might have delayed his assignment. For every possible contingency, he knew how much water he would need. He doubted his figures were absolutely precise, but they didn't have to be. All that mattered was that his work be done before the first person entered the Registry of Motor Vehicles in the morning. If anyone came in before, everything would be ruined. He had been told not to get violent with the prisoner unless absolutely necessary. Of course, being told he couldn't do it had only made him want to do it even more. It was yet another wave added to the tumultuous sea of white caps roiling inside him. He tried to focus on the minutiae of his assignment, the importance of completing the job properly and not leaving behind any clues. The distraction worked at first, but its force soon began to wane. He was tempted, so tempted, to abuse the man, to break him mentally and emotionally, to have him weep and beg for his life. He positioned himself so that the man could watch him knotting the heavy rope and made sure he could also see the backboard that had been prepared specially for him. He wanted to ask the man if he'd ever heard of an engineer named Reuben Garrett Lucius Goldberg, or simply Rube Goldberg for short. He wanted to share how Mr. Goldberg had inspired the contraption he had built and lay everything out for the man so he could watch the already intense fear in his eyes build to an even greater degree. He knew, though, that if he toyed with the mouse, he might very well end up eating it, and that was strictly forbidden. Everything had to be done according to the instructions. Any deviation, and everything would be ruined. He tried to take his mind off the man in front of him. His thoughts wandered to the woman he had taken from Sea Island, how powerful he had felt with her life in his hands, and what it was like extinguishing her. It was like the final wisp of smoke rising from a candle wick. One moment there was pain and fear and death in her eyes, then release, as everything just slipped away. But he hadn't been able to savor it. He had wanted to take more time, especially with her ears, but his schedule meant that he had to keep moving. That woman and the one in the cemetery made two back-to-back now, who had gotten him significantly aroused without his being able to do anything about it. Tonight, after his work here was complete, he would find a way to change that. He deserved a reward. The mere thought of taking a woman shortly sent a pulse of excitement racing through his body. He now had the perfect goal to get him through what he had to finish, and he focused on his task like a laser. He finished his knots, placed everything just so, and even went back and rechecked his calculations for a fifth time. Once he was confident he had everything all set up exactly as it needed to be, he removed his cordless drill and selected a drill bit. The prisoner's eyes widened as the killer attached the bit and then gave the power tool's trigger a quick press to make sure it worked. It did. Satisfied, the killer closed the box of bits and began walking toward his victim. Before he even reached him, the man started to scream from behind his gag. The killer wasn't listening. Raising the spinning drill in front of him, he reveled in the high-pitched whine and watched the bit as it was transformed into a blur of sharp gray metal. It was so ingenious, easily one of the cleverest ways ever devised to kill.
Chapter 26. Bill Wise had sent Harvath home with a stack of books. The two he wanted him to focus on were The Creature from Jekyll Island and Economics in One Lesson. The Jekyll Island book, all about the secrets behind the Federal Reserve, was thick enough to be a doorstop. Thankfully, its author encouraged readers to skip around in it and not read it from cover to cover. Harvath loved to read, and if he'd had the time, he might have tackled it from front to back. Instead, he followed the author's advice and read the summaries at the end of each chapter, and then dipped into the chapters that interested him the most. Economics in One Lesson was a sliver of a book in comparison. Like The Creature from Jekyll Island, it was well written and easy to read. He was halfway through it before finishing his first cup of coffee. The slim volume had originally caught his eye, because its author was the same Henry Hazlitt whose economics quote had been hung around Claire Marcourt's neck. He was plowing through the book not only in hopes of better understanding the killer or killer's mindset, but also because of how interesting it was and how much he was learning. Despite not having hit the sack until well past midnight, he awoke at 5 a.m., feeling rested, and decided to go for a run. 4 miles in, he could feel his IT band tightening up. He hadn't stretched as well as he should have, and now his body was punishing him for it. He pushed himself to his 5-mile marker and then turned back toward home. It was a cloudy, overcast morning with lots of humidity that hinted at a good rain at some point during the day. It was a good thing he was getting his run in now. As he ran, lots of things passed through his mind, predominantly about the case. He made a mental note to call Bill Wise after breakfast to see if he had made any progress. Arriving back home, Harvath showered, shaved, and was downstairs with the TV on cooking breakfast when the old man called.
"You need to get to Boston," he said without so much as a good morning.
Harvath muted his TV.
"What's going on? What happened?"
"There's been a second victim."
"Who?"
"Herman Penning. Boston. I want you to get up there as soon as possible. Lewis says you can use the Fed's plane. He has it standing by."
Harvath looked at his watch.
"I can be out the door in 15 minutes.
"Be out the door in 5. I want you there before the trail goes cold, or the Boston cops muck it all up. I'll send what I've got to your phone. You can read it on the plane."
After shoveling his half-cooked eggs into the garbage, he ran upstairs to get dressed. Flying private, he didn't have to worry about carrying weapons, so he gunned up and grabbed a bunch of extra magazines. He also grabbed his knife, flashlight, a handful of easy cuff restraints, his cell phone, charger, and a small digital camera, then laid everything out on the bed. Studying the items as he hastily tied his tie, he guessed there were probably a bunch of things he was forgetting and would later wish he'd thought to bring, but that was too bad. He had to get moving. He pulled his Scotty vest trench coat out of the closet, slipped his gear into its multiple pockets, and then, grabbing the overnight bag he always kept ready, headed for the door. The traffic on the George Washington Memorial Parkway was lighter than usual. Had he left home even a minute later, he had no doubt that he'd be sitting still right now instead of proceeding apace to Reagan National. He allowed himself to believe that somewhere up there he was being watched out for. Then, 4 miles from the airport, the rain began to fall, and right on cue, the traffic slowed to almost a stop. He decided to suffer the honks and explosion of one-fingered rush-hour salutes by driving up the shoulder. In an attempt to at least make himself look somewhat official in his black Chevy Tahoe, he kept flashing his brights. No one bought it. He could hear people honking, and, looking in his rearview mirror, he saw the phalanx of left hands with middle fingers extended pop out of one car window after another. The only good part was that nobody seemed to notice him and what he was doing until he'd already passed. In other words, nobody had been able to move halfway onto the shoulder in front of him in a preemptive block. The world, unfortunately, was filled with people who felt the rules didn't apply to them. They were folks who felt entitled to do whatever they wanted, and Harvath had no doubt that several of them, late for a flight at Reagan National, likely had attempted this same up-the-shoulder maneuver before. What was even more certain was that a vehicle speeding toward the airport, disobeying traffic laws, was going to be seen by law enforcement as a threat. Harvath stayed on the shoulder for as long as he could, and then, to an almost choreographed opera of additional horns and middle fingers, he muscled his way back into the creeping flow of traffic and over to the far right lane so he could exit. He parked at the signature flight support FBO, checked in, and was escorted out to the Ariane SBJ. The crew was assembled at the bottom of the air stairs waiting for him, and while he was slightly disappointed that the flight attendant wasn't Natalie, it was probably a blessing in disguise. He needed to focus on the task at hand. The crew, as one would expect on such an expensive private aircraft, was exceedingly professional. Harvath, while trying his best to be polite, encouraged them to dispense with the formalities and get off the ground as quickly as possible. He needed to be there yesterday. They all understood. With the pre-flight check already complete and the tower ready to bump them to the head of the list as soon as they were ready, Harvath was encouraged to take his seat and buckle up, which he did. Less than 15 minutes later, they were airborne. The flight to Boston's Logan Airport was faster than any shuttle flight he had ever experienced from D.C. No sooner had they climbed up and out over the Atlantic than they had passed New York City and were making their descent and landing. The flight attendant had apologized for not being able to offer him anything more than coffee and Dunkin' Donuts. They hadn't received much heads up either, and there'd been no time to alert the airport catering company. Harvath told her not to worry. While he wasn't a donut guy, he did enjoy their coffee and had been glad to have at least gotten something in his system. As he scrolled through the information the old man had sent to his phone, Anna, the flight attendant, kept his cup topped off. When the sleek supersonic business jet landed at Logan, Harvath was as up to speed as he expected to be until he reached the crime scene. Carlton had texted that travel into the city had already been arranged. Harvath assumed that meant someone, though likely not as attractive as Sloane Ashby, was going to meet him at the Logan FBO and drive him in. After opening the main cabin door and lowering the air stairs, the flight attendant apologized again for the lack of breakfast. She offered Harvath a couple of donuts for the road if he wanted, but he smiled and said, "No, thank you," as he disembarked. Stepping onto the tarmac, he noticed a clean-cut man in a navy suit, standing next to a plain sedan, talking on his cell phone. "That must be my ride." As his passenger approached, the man pulled the phone away from his ear for a moment and asked, "Harvath?" Harvath nodded, and the man ended his call. After sliding the phone back into his pocket, he extended his hand. "I'm Special Agent Montgomery, Boston Field Office."
"Short straw, huh?" he said as they shook hands. "Thanks for coming to pick me up."
"No problem. I was on my way into work anyway. Besides, this will be the first time I've used lights and sirens in Boston. You need a pit stop before we get on the road?"
He shook his head. "Good to go."
Montgomery threw his bag in back, and once Harvath was in the passenger seat and buckled up, the agent activated his lights and siren and raced out of the airport, headed for downtown. Chapter 27. Despite the crush of morning traffic, they finally arrived at their destination, 630 Washington Street. Looking up, Harvath wasn't surprised to see that the body had been removed. A host of gruesome photos taken by passers-by was already making the rounds of the internet. Interestingly enough, many of the amateur photographers had failed to capture the enormous plaque embedded in the building's red brick facade, commemorating the structure's significance. Known as the Liberty Tree Building, it marked the location of a famous elm tree from which an effigy was hung in protest in 1765. The effigy represented Andrew Oliver, the man Mad King George had appointed to carry out the Stamp Act tax on the American colonies, and it drew a very large crowd, the first of its kind in public against the king. It was considered a seminal moment leading up to the Revolutionary War, and the men who had hung Oliver in effigy would go on to call themselves the Sons of Liberty. Harvath wasn't surprised at all that this location had been chosen for another symbolic murder. A Boston PD patrolman was blocking the main entrance. As Harvath grabbed his bag out of the back, Montgomery stepped up to the officer and flashed his FBI credentials and told him to let Harvath pass. The young FBI agent had already explained he was working another case and was only functioning as his driver. Harvath thanked him for the ride as the patrolman said, "Fourth floor," and waved him inside. Harvath rode the elevator upstairs and stepped out into a hive of activity. There were crime scene technicians, uniformed police officers, detectives, and FBI agents. They all had short hair, and while the FBI agents were all trim and in good shape, the cops looked like cops everywhere and represented a wide range of physical fitness levels. The patrolman downstairs had already radioed up to the officer controlling the inner perimeter of the crime scene and had told him to let Harvath pass. The officer directed Harvath down the hall to where a pair of technicians, who had ostensibly photographed everything, was beginning to disassemble a very odd contraption. There were old-fashioned wooden pulleys, hooks, and lengths of rough, fibrous rope that looked like they were twisted from hemp.
"Can you hold off for a second, please, fellas?" he asked the CSTs. "I'd like to take a look at all this."
"Just what this investigation needs," one of them said derisively. "Another fed." "You picking up the overtime?" his colleague asked. Apparently, there wasn't a lot of love lost between the Boston PD and the FBI. Harvath wasn't surprised. The Boston Homicide Unit had some excellent detectives, but overall, a terrible and unfortunately long-standing record when it came to their ability to actually solve murders. On multiple cases, the FBI had been forced to come in and bat cleanup. It was a source of embarrassment for the city, and they had been working hard to turn things around. Nevertheless, it didn't excuse the attitude Harvath was getting.
"No, I'm not picking up your overtime," he replied. "In fact, I'd be happy to recommend you both for a permanent vacation."
"And just who the hell are you anyway?" the first CST demanded.
"Wyatt Earp,"
Harvath replied, shooting him a very serious don't-fuck-with-me look that backed the man down. Smiling, he suggested,
"Why don't you two take a break and get a cup of coffee? I'll only be a few minutes."
"Fine by me, pal," the short-tempered tech said, as he stopped what he was working on, stood up, and gestured for his partner to follow. Harvath was glad to be able to have a few minutes to work in peace. Stepping back, he took the entire contraption in piece by piece. From an engineering standpoint, it was ingenious. Everything had been assembled facing the broken window. The ropes and pulleys were suspended from the sprinkler pipes and helped balance a polished plank of wood atop a modified fulcrum. The plank actually comprised three pieces of wood fitted together, which likely had made it easier to transport. Holes were drilled on each side to accommodate the ropes. At first, Harvath had thought that all of the water had come from a broken sprinkler pipe. The problem was that only the floor was wet. No other surface areas were, not the desks, not the file cabinets, not even the windowsills. Looking around, he noticed the large plastic industrial garbage can on wheels again. Originally, he hadn't paid much attention to it, figuring the can belonged to a cleaning crew or something. Now, his interest was piqued. Removing his flashlight, he walked over to the can and shined some light inside. It was streaked with moisture, and there was a small puddle of what looked to be water in the bottom. There was also something else. Returning his flashlight to his pocket, he bent down and examined the exterior of the can. Near the very bottom, he found it. It appeared that the can had been filled with water, but that someone had drilled a hole at the bottom to let the water out. Why? Harvath stood and went back over to the plank and re-examined everything. That's when it hit him. The killer, or killers, had probably left long before Herman Penning was even dead. It was all making sense now, and what he had originally seen as ingenious was quickly reaching the brilliance level. The 60-year-old man had been fitted with a noose and was then placed onto the plank, which would function like a chute. When the appointed moment arrived, the chute tipped forward, and gravity jettisoned the father of two and grandfather of four through the window. The man then fell, but only until he reached the literal end of his rope, at which point his neck was snapped. Judging by the size of the garbage can and how much water it could hold, it had functioned like a timer. Secured to the plank, it would have acted as a counterbalance, holding it horizontal for as long as its weight was greater than the victim's. As soon as that ratio changed, gravity would take over. After taking several pictures of everything, Harvath grabbed a chair in order to better examine the pulleys. He'd only been up on it for a few moments when he heard a throat being cleared behind him. He turned around to see a man and a woman, shields on their belts and their hands very near their weapons.
"Agent Wyatt Earp, is it?" the woman said. "I'm Detective Annie Oakley, and this is my partner, Buffalo Bill. Why don't you step down? We'd like to have a word with you, please."
Chapter 28. Annie Oakley turned out to be Boston Police Homicide Detective Lara Cordero. Her partner's name sounded like Sabatelli or Sabatano, but Harvath didn't catch it. He wasn't really paying attention at that point. He was trying to not appear as if he was staring at Cordero, while he was, in fact, staring at Cordero. She was a very exotic-looking woman, and quite attractive. A knockout, actually. If Harvath had to guess, he would have pegged her as maybe Spanish with something else. It was hard to discern. She was in her early 30s, tall, tan, and took very good care of herself. She had green eyes and long brown hair that was streaked blonde by the sun. Harvath introduced himself and presented each of them with a crisp white business card embossed with his company's name and a phone number. Nothing else.
"So, you're the kidnap and ransom specialist," said Cordero. "I wasn't aware that the kidnappers had made any demands."
"They haven't," Harvath replied. "Not yet."
"Maybe it got lost in the mail," her partner said.
While Cordero's Boston accent was almost non-existent, this guy's was over the top. It had an edge to it, too, that Harvath didn't care for.
"Who's the client?" Cordero asked.
The old man had warned him to be ready for this question. The FBI was being circumspect with the details it was sharing with the Boston PD. Monroe Lewis had told him to do the same.
"The deceased has some very powerful friends in Washington."
"Had," Cordero's partner corrected him. "Past tense."
Harvath studied him for a moment. He was dressed in a halfway decent suit. Other than that, there wasn't anything particularly impressive about him. He wasn't short, he wasn't tall, and his features were unremarkable. He looked to be in decent shape compared to a lot of the other cops in the room, but that wasn't saying much. It was obvious that the man didn't like him, and that was fine by Harvath, who was about to thank him for the English lesson when Cordero asked another question.
"So what's your background?"
"Why do you ask?" Harvath replied.
"You don't strike me as the law enforcement type."
"Is that so?"
"Yeah. You've got more of a military vibe to me. They hire a lot of ex-special forces types for kidnap and ransom companies, right? What are you, an Army Ranger or maybe a Navy SEAL?"
It was either an incredibly good guess, or she was intentionally flirting with him. He couldn't tell. Either way, he didn't really want to get into what his background was and laughed it off.
"A SEAL? They only take smart guys," he replied. "Plus, I can't swim."
Cordero smiled.
"I think you may be downplaying the smarts part."
"Why's that?"
"Because I was watching the way you examined the pulleys and the rest of the crime scene."
"I did that good of a job, huh? How about we trade places and I'll watch you this time? Maybe I can learn something."
"How about we go swimming instead?" the partner interjected.
Good one, but this guy was getting on Harvath's nerves. He ignored him and said to Cordero,
"Who found the victim?"
"About half of Boston," she replied. "We're right downtown. We've got lots of people on their way to work.
Our 911 center was flooded with calls. A patrol unit responded within about 4 minutes. Within 15 minutes of arriving on scene, they had accessed the building and retrieved Penning's body. They'd hoped that he was still alive, and one of the officers even tried to resuscitate him. But we're confident his neck was broken instantly. There's nothing they could have done."
"Where's the body now?"
on its way to the ME.
Harvath leaned and looked out the window to the street below.
Any CCTV footage, traffic cams, that sort of thing you can pull from the area?
Why didn't we think of that? The male detective snarked.
What I meant to say, Harvath began,
but Cordero interrupted him.
I know what you meant, and yes, we've got a few cameras we've already requested footage from. We're not holding out much hope, though.
Why not?
Because we've already checked the security cameras here in this building. As far as that footage is concerned, no one ever entered.
The footage was looped, said Harvath.
Cordero nodded.
With that level of sophistication, plus getting around the alarm system and no signs of forced entry into the building, we think the chances are slim that we'll get him on any of the cameras. But you never know. They got the Son of Sam with parking tickets, right?
Have you uncovered anything else unusual?
The woman's partner rolled his eyes.
Nah. We see murder scenes with ropes and pulleys and little dolls every day.
Dolls? Harvath repeated.
Yeah. It was shoved into the boot Penning was wearing.
He was wearing only one?
We think the other one fell off, and maybe some homeless person picked it up or something. We're looking into it.
No doubt, replied Harvath. Let me ask you about the victim's boot. Was the sole painted green?
Yeah, it was.
And the doll? Does it look like a little devil?
Yeah, the man answered, his eyes narrowing. How'd you know that?
Harvath plowed forward.
It's grinning and holding a scroll, too, right?
What the fuck? How do you know all this?
Harvath held up his hands and looked around as if it were obvious.
This is the Liberty Tree building, right?
The male detective mimicked Harvath's gesture and replied,
It obviously ain't Fenway Park, so what?
It's not important. Never mind.
Cordero, to her credit, knew that it was important, and that Harvath understood much more than he was letting on.
Sal, can you give us a few minutes, please? She asked.
Her partner looked at Harvath and then back at her. He didn't like being asked to leave. It made him feel as if he were some sort of impediment, and that hurt his pride. He paused just long enough to suggest that he was trying to come up with something clever to say, but nothing materialized. Finally, he replied,
No problem. I need to talk with the uniforms anyway and see how the canvas of the neighborhood is going.
Thanks, Sal, Cordero replied. I'll be down shortly.
Mr. Harvath, he said, drawing out the word Mr. as if to highlight Harvath's non-law enforcement status, before turning on his cheap shoes and walking away.
Interesting guy, Harvath said, once the man was out of earshot.
He means well.
You two been together long?
Partners for 6 years. Best cop I've ever known. Loyal, and nobody knows the streets better than him.
I don't think he likes me.
I can see it's breaking your heart.
I'm insecure like that.
Cordero stifled a laugh.
Yeah, you've got insecurity written all over you. That was the first thing I noticed when you came in.
What was the second?
Ignoring his question, she said,
Follow me. I want to show you something.
As they walked, Cordero asked,
How did you know about the boot and the doll and all that?
I paid attention in class.
And what class would that be?
American history, said Harvath. Boston colonists hung an effigy of Andrew Oliver, the man chosen by King George to impose the Stamp Act. They hung it from an elm tree right on this spot that became known as the Liberty Tree. Along with it, they also hung a British cavalry jackboot with its sole painted green. It was meant as an up yours to two British prime ministers tied to the Stamp Act. One was named Grenville and the other Bute. Grinning from inside the boot was a devil doll holding a scroll with the words Stamp Act written on it.
The female detective nodded as she turned the information in her mind.
I guess I really didn't pay enough attention in class.
You walk by history every day in Boston.
But nobody's ever a tourist in their own hometown, are they?
That was true.
Did you grow up here? He asked.
We moved here when I was a little girl. I was born in another country.
Is Cordero Spanish?
No, Portuguese, but via
Brazil,
Harvath replied. Everything about her falling into place. She stopped and smiled.
Very good, she said. You know your geography.
My parents felt bad that they couldn't afford swimming lessons, so they gave me a globe instead. I got rather good with it.
Your insecurity is showing again.
Is it? Harvath asked, glancing over his shoulder. I'm going to have to get a better tailor.
Cordero started walking again.
Been there recently?
Brazil?
Yes, a few years ago, but only a quick in and out for business.
Kidnap and ransom business?
You could call it that,
he replied, as he remembered traveling there to track down a man he believed to be involved with the torture and killing of several friends and family of his. The female detective appraised him once more, this time with a bit more appreciation.
Maybe you actually could be Navy SEAL material.
Except for the swimming and the smart stuff.
Except for those, she agreed with a smile, as they arrived at a long counter where the evidence technicians had arrayed everything that had been bagged, tagged, and would soon be dragged to headquarters once the rope, plank, and pulley apparatus was disassembled and packed up.
Here, she said, tossing Harvath a pair of latex gloves.
Anything you see and want to touch, please, just ask my permission first.
There were only a million responses that rushed to the front of Harvath's brain at that point, but being the consummate professional that he was, he refrained from all of them.
Why don't we start with the doll?
Cordero nodded at her evidence tech, who presented a log and asked Harvath to print and sign his name before allowing him to examine the item. Harvath didn't need to remove the grinning demon from its clear plastic bag. He only wanted to see what was on its little scroll.
Does anyone have a magnifying glass or something like that I can use on this?
The evidence tech borrowed one from a crime scene technician and handed it to him. Harvath held up the bag so he could get as much light on it as possible. Upon the scroll had been drawn the same skull and crossbones with a hovering crown that he had seen in the Claire Marcourt crime scene photos. Beneath it were written the words, Death to Tyranny, and beneath that were the initials S.O.L. Harvath thanked the evidence tech and handed back the doll and the magnifying glass.
Any idea what any of the writing stands for? Cordero asked.
She wasn't asking for state secrets. A few minutes on a web browser and she'd be able to figure it out for herself.
Death to Tyranny and the skull and bones motif with the crown summarized popular anti-British sentiments in the colonies leading up to the Revolutionary War, he said. We think SOL may be shorthand for Sons of Liberty. They were an organized resistance group back then, and were believed to have been responsible for hanging the Oliver effigy in the Liberty Tree.
Cordero jotted a couple of notes in a notebook, then asked,
What's the connection to our victim, Mr. Penning?
Now she was drifting into state secrets.
What do you mean?
Why so heavy on the symbolism?
Maybe somebody thought he was a tyrant.
What do you think?
I barely know anything about the man, certainly not enough to have an opinion.
Glancing back at the ropes and pulleys, then returning her gaze to Harvath, the detective said,
This all looks pretty personal.
The killer definitely wanted to send a message.
Death to tyranny?
Pretty nonspecific if you ask me, she replied.
Making a final mark in her notebook, she looked up and asked,
What else would you like to take a look at?
Harvath scanned the table. There wasn't really anything else of interest. Nothing that screamed, lead.
I think we're good.
Okay,
she replied, adding her own signature to the evidence log and letting the tech know he could take everything down to the lab.
Now, let's talk about why you're really here.
I told you, detective, the victim has, excuse me, had some very powerful friends in D.C.
First, the FBI pretends all it knows is that Penning was kidnapped. Then we find out there were four others grabbed the same night. But the FBI won't tell us what they have in common. You don't have to be a detective to pick up on the fact that they're probably holding something back.
Now a wise-cracking James Blonde type in the K&R business shows up at my murder scene knowing a bit too much about American history and won't tell me who the client is. You'll forgive me if my BS meter is drifting into the red zone.
James Blonde. He'd have to remember that one. I imagine your job requires you to be a little suspicious about everything.
And everyone, she added.
Harvath smiled and tried to change the subject.
What can you tell me about the circumstances surrounding Penning's kidnapping?
Nothing.
Nothing?
That's right,
she replied, her right forearm resting on the butt of her holstered pistol.
I think you know a lot more than you're telling me. Can we help each other? Maybe. Maybe not. But I'm not giving you anything else until you come clean with me. I could call back to Washington and have some of Mr. Penning's friends call your chief.
Cordero nodded. You could do that. But the chief would only kick it down to my commander, who would end up assigning Sal to be your liaison.
Mamma mia, can that guy be slow in handling requests, especially if he doesn't like you?
Which he doesn't.
So why not just cooperate and make it easy on yourself?
I bet you use that line on all the guys you meet at murder scenes.
Only if it's the right guys, and I haven't already put a bullet in them.
Harvath thought about her offer. When it came to investigating a murder, you wanted to be as close to the streets as possible, and that meant lashing up with the cops. No matter what happened, it was much more likely that the Boston PD would hear about it before the FBI. In the end, he needed her cooperation.
Okay, I'll tell you what, he said. Take me someplace for breakfast. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Anything?
Anything within reason.
Cordero didn't like the qualifier, but it left the door open.
I know a place not far from here, she replied. We'll take my car.
Chapter 29. Since Cordero and her partner had both arrived at the Liberty Tree building in separate vehicles, she told him she would catch up with him at headquarters later and drove Harvath to the city's Beacon Hill neighborhood. The Paramount was a local institution known for its breakfast by generations of Bostonians. That was her primary reason for taking Harvath there. There was also a secondary reason. She wanted to prove she wasn't completely illiterate when it came to Boston history. She waited until he had ordered and they'd both been served coffee to fill him in.
Really? Harvath said. It happened here.
Cordero nodded.
Right upstairs. Her name was Mary Sullivan. She was 19 years old and the Boston Strangler's final victim.
I saw a documentary about him. He was a sick guy.
I've seen the crime scene photos. You have no idea.
Harvath took a sip of his coffee and set the cup back down on the table.
They caught the guy, though, didn't they?
They caught a guy, a rapist named Albert DeSalvo. He allegedly confessed while being held in jail for a rape he committed 9 months after the rape and murder of Mary Sullivan. There still remain a lot of doubts as to whether or not DeSalvo was the actual strangler, or if there may have been more than one killer.
What do you think?
I think DeSalvo knew too many details about the crime scenes not to have been involved, she replied. Either he was the killer, or he knew the killers. Either way, it was good to get him off the streets.
That was when, exactly?
Early 1960s? Harvath asked.
Yep. The murder started in June 1962, with the last one occurring upstairs with Mary Sullivan on January 4th, 1964. There were 14 women, all between the ages of 19 and 85, murdered.
DeSalvo got life in prison, right?
Yes, but it was for the long string of robberies and sexual offenses he had committed before the Strangler murders. The police couldn't find any physical evidence tying him to the murder scenes.
Did he know some pretty impressive details that hadn't been released to the public?
Yes, but that wasn't enough to charge him with.
Harvath shook his head.
Plus, he had O.J. Simpson's lawyer, didn't he?
He did. F. Lee Bailey. Bailey was representing the jailhouse snitch whom DeSalvo originally admitted being the strangler to. When Bailey heard that, he scooped DeSalvo up. He tried to get a not guilty on everything by reason of insanity, but the court didn't buy it.
But he did get life in prison.
He did. He also escaped that same year, only to turn himself back in the next day. 6 years later, though, he was jumped in the prison infirmary and stabbed to death. The killer, or killers, were never caught.
At least justice was finally done, and the people of Massachusetts didn't have to foot his bill anymore.
Cordero nodded, just as Harvath's Spanish omelet showed up.
You sure you don't want anything? He asked.
I'm good, she said. I ate before I left the house this morning. Most important meal of the day, you know.
Harvath smiled.
That's exactly what I was thinking this morning, as I was cooking my eggs and the call came in telling me to get up here.
Why'd you know so much about the whole Liberty Tree thing? She asked,
changing the subject. And please, save me the whole I paid attention in class response again, okay? She was a very perceptive woman, an important trait for a homicide detective, or any detective for that matter. You'd have to get up pretty early in the morning to put one over on her, and even then, Harbath was not sure how successful he'd be. That being the case, there wasn't any reason to lie to her. He just needed to refrain from telling her the entire truth. It was something that was on a need-to-know basis, and she didn't need to know.
You said that the FBI told you that Penning was one in a string of kidnappings, right?
Right.
Well, what they didn't tell you was that he wasn't the first victim to be killed.
Cordero looked to make sure no one was listening to their conversation and then leaned in closer.
Another murder? When? Where did it happen?
Finishing what was in his mouth, he said,
Sunday night, a small island off the coast of Georgia.
Same M.O.?
He had no idea how hungry he had been until he began eating, and nodded as he took another bite.
The killer left a note there, too.
What did it say?
It was about the Tree of Liberty needing to be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants.
Another death to tyranny reference?
Harvath nodded again, as he set his fork down and reached to take a sip of water.
Same skull and crossbones with the crown, too.
The FBI wouldn't say how the victims are related. Is it family? Personal relationship? Business? What are we talking about?
I'm not at liberty to discuss that, specifically.
What is it?
Above my pay grade?
Mine, too.